Good.
Which one's this one?
David, could you close this door? We're going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. We're going to go a little bit out of order. I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 2781. And I apologize for starting late. We try to make an effort to start on time, but things are getting very exciting in the Capitol, and there are a lot of people scurrying around trying to do last-minute things, so I apologize for starting late. I'm opening up a work session on 2781. We're going to carry this over to April 15th, close the work session on 2781. I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 3032, and I'm carrying that also to April 17th, close the work session. And
which one?
So I'm going to open what? Okay, we're going to open up the work session on House Bill 3007. That you tell us because we're going to ask some questions.
Okay, Madam Chair and members of the committee, if you want to. Are you wanting to carry this bill over?
Yes, but right now you're okay. Going to tell us what the bill does.
Oh, I'd be happy to do that. Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3007 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It directs the owner of a residential facility to offer tenants opportunity to purchase facility before owner offers sale of facility to third party. It establishes a process for tenants to purchase facility.
Thank you, Regina. And Representative Wisden, I think you have some questions to ask. Are you wanting to do that publicly now, or do you want that in writing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The CASA rep did not show up yet, and I have a lot of questions for him.
That's right. I said I would hold it. So I'm going to close. Did you want to ask anybody who lives here?
I think John can come back.
Do you have questions for Mr. Van Landingham?
I can give him now, or he can come back. Either your chair's choice.
Why don't we have him come up? Because I know there are people here. And we're waiting for another person from CASA to attend also. And so we probably will hear what Mr. Van Landingham has to say in response to your questions. And then we'll close it and open up later, see if somebody from CASA is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that very much. If the committee remembers, we're in a work session. So we had a lot of testimony about this by John. He spent a lot of time talking about the people he represented. But there was a lot of people that we didn't get to hear from. I'd like to ask some questions about that. Peter's here.
Okay.
So we can
Peter,
do that.
Come on up. Thank you. And this is not a debate. This is some questions that Representative Wisden has.
And I was not able to give them to Peter ahead of time. I did discuss them with John ahead of time. Madam Chair, do you want me to begin?
Yes.
Mr. Lingen? John? Got to say Mr. John. And looking at this, and I appreciate the chair's position. I appreciate your argument. I think every member of this committee wants to be sure that the people living in these homes are able to live there at a reasonable price, and they also given the opportunity to purchase. What it didn't, I don't think, came out in the previous testimony, committee members, that ORS 90.820 offers the people the right to purchase now, and we also heard testimony that some owners have purchased parks in the recent past. So my question to John is, what's the problem with the rules we have now?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisden, I want to thank you for asking me these questions and giving me a chance to respond. Let me begin by noting that the current laws were adopted in 1989 at a time when there was another park closure crisis in the state of Oregon, and the residents asked the legislature to prevent closures, regulate rents, do rent control, and have the state enforce landlord-tenant law. And the legislature then said, no, we're not going to do that, being close. We're going to give residents an opportunity to purchase. Those laws are the ones that you referred to. They've been on the books since 1989. I believe they don't work for either side, and I have had the lawyer for MHCO, the landlord's organization, say the same thing. those laws, in that lawyer's opinion, do impose a right of first refusal with no exception for 1031 exchange buyers, in other words, unsolicited offers. So that's a huge problem for under current law. I gave you a memo when I testified on March 20th that outlined my view of what the problems are, and I'll be glad to give you that again. I brought one extra copy now. I know you get flooded with paper, so I'm not critical that you don't have that right at your fingertips. But there are, for example, one of the provisions of that law is that a landlord has to give notice if a tenant association gives written notice to the landlord saying we're interested in buying. There is no deadline on how long that notice is good for.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just
I'm sorry. I was going to keep going.
The Chair wants me to be as quick and as brief as I can. If I remember, may I just continue?
Thank you.
If I remember correctly, when my first or second session, we had the homeowner crisis, and we had a lot of the home people come in, and we made passed legislation that helped them, gave them money to move, and things like that. But this issue wasn't brought up during that time.
Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, that I believe was in 2007 and 2009. Was that 2009 was your first session?
No. That's okay.
I didn't understand the concept of resident purchase until 2005 when the State Housing and Community Services paid my way to a conference in New Hampshire to understand what they do and how successful that is. I came back from that having drunk the Kool-Aid, and I've spent time since 2005 working on this and a number of other ideas that are related to it.
Okay.
So,
and thank you. I appreciate short answer or reply, because otherwise I'll get the Chair mad at me. So, sir, we discussed this outside briefly before the meeting. I'm a member of one of the largest homeowner associations, I think, in Oregon, in Sun River. I know as a member of a homeowner association, we have to pay a lot of money, and we also have to have a capital fund to repair our buildings and a manufactured home park. I would imagine the requirement would be to have a capital reserve fund for the sewer, the water, the roads, and any other recreational activities are there. Are homeowner associations that are now owned by the owners, are they complying with those requirements by the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisden, thank you for that question. I do not know the answer, and I will try to find out.
And Madam Chair, I'm not trying to. It's okay to keep going.
Yes.
Okay.
I think Peter has it.
Yeah. Okay, well, for the record, Peter Hanley, Executive Director of CASA of Oregon, Sherwood, Oregon. We require that there be reserves for any future capital repairs. In fact, most of the financing sources that we go for require that.
Are in accordance with state law now?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, state law does not apply. This is not a homeowner association per se.
Why not?
It's a special form of co-op that was made. What year
it's
was it?
2009 was one of the things that we did. Was the legislature adopted a provision creating a nonprofit manufactured dwelling park co-op?
But part of the organizing process, we require that they do a capital plan, and most of the funding sources require that we make sure that we upgrade all of the infrastructure.
Okay, thank you.
But I will research that and get back.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think, John, that was all, unless you want to stay there and contribute. Peter, are CASA representative licensed real estate brokers?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we are not. We have a licensed broker on staff.
So is CASA compensated for your transactions when you help the
owner? Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we are not compensated.
Could you explain, Peter, to me why Clackamas River Village sold for $5 million, but the mortgage was for $5,375,000?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the sales price includes some technical assistance fees for us to do the transaction, as well as other closing fees required by our lenders. I can provide a complete settlement statement for you that shows all the closing costs.
Okay. John left us. You can maybe answer this.
May return.
New Hampshire, because he quoted New Hampshire, it's my understanding, the information I've received, nearly a quarter of the resident-owned communities cannot fund their necessary infrastructure. Have you heard anything about that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisden, I wish I had done this earlier. I sent you all a 7-page memo responding to landlord criticisms at about 1:30 today. And I addressed that issue in that memo.
Good.
The short answer is that's not true.
Okay. Thank you. In the, Peter, the parks that the owners have bought, what is the normal property management fee? How much more did that add to the rent?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, typically the fees that the management fees are comparable to what a private investor would be paying. In fact, in many cases, we've continued to use Commonwealth as the property management agent. They may go down a little bit, but it's typically about the same. So it's not, that is not adding any cost to it.
Okay. One of the letters I received asking my support of this bill, the good person asked that owners be given a fair chance to buy. But don't you think they have a fair chance now with what the current statute? Because it's worked.
You mean the co-op, the residents in the park be given a fair chance to buy?
What's wrong with the current law and why doesn't it work?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, what happens is that the residents don't ever get notified that there's going to be, that the park is coming up for sale. That is the primary purpose. A lot of these sales happen through brokers. Yeah, the brokers contact a broker, and they're transferred that way.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I put into the OLA system for the committee members two letters from Charles M. Greff, a lawyer who represents the park owners. His position, and I'd like to summarize this the best I can, and then we'll go on, Madam Chair. His position is that this is bad legislation because he believes ORS 90.820 does provide park residents with a right of first refusal. And as we know and we discussed in this committee, the problem with this bill is it does stretch it out to 100 days instead of the 14-day period we had in the current legislation.
Do you have any more questions, Representative?
Yeah, I want to finish my statements.
I did not allow a statement. I said we would have questions. Do you have any other questions?
Well, I'd like to make comment as a member of the committee. We're in a work session.
We are in a work session, but
no, ma'am.
I just opened it now so that you could ask questions, and we'll have another work session.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, with that, we will close the work session on 307, and we will carry it over until the 15th is Monday, so the 15th. Thank you. We're meeting on the fiscal for 3112. Who's going to make a comment? Today or Friday? Okay. So we're going to open up the work session on 3244. We're carrying it over until Friday the 12th, right?
Yes.
Thank you.
Or you carry it over to me.
All right. So we're waiting for the fiscal for 2205.
Did you say 3244?
Yes.
Yes.
We're going to start from the beginning of your calendar.
Yes. So, again, we need the fiscal on 2205, right?
That's
Representative
right.
Gilliam, is that right? We're still waiting for the fiscal on 2205?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay, so we're going to be opening up House Bill 2055 and House Bill 3440. And our intention is to send both of these to TANF.
To
Ways and Means. It is TANF. Thank you. So,
2055 and 3440?
Yes.
3440, yes.
Madam Chair and
yes.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2055 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It has a -1 amendment. It extends the sunset on changes to the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. It declares an emergency effective upon passage. And then House Bill 3440 has no revenue impact. A fiscal statement was issued, and it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and a dash one amendment. It establishes the total aid paid to family during single period of eligibility during calendar year 2013 at $1,000. It requires the Department of Human Services to provide employment retention assistance to families receiving TANF services. It clarifies suitable activities for employed caretaker relatives and modifies the time period and calculation for families to receive aid. It contains an emergency clause effective upon passage.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Rick.
Which one do you want to do first?
Do we do them together as?
Okay.
All right. Sure, individually first.
Would you say?
Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2055, dated 4513.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2055, dated 4513. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2055 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and add a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2055 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and add a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I will vote for this bill, but with some serious reservations. This bill basically extends the suspension that we have on certain TANF programs, the job-related programs that I think are really, really vital. It does allow that they could be picked up if there are enough appropriations. I would love to see more of a conversation about how else TANF could be peering back if needed. For instance, putting more toward the 0 to 5 age population that doesn't have access to the food programs. I will bring this up with Ways and Means. It's just in the rush of everything, it's hard to have a full conversation about that. There's also some provisions limiting ERDC, for instance, denying employment-related daycare assistance to parents who are self-employed. I just want to get on the record that I have some serious reservations about this. Not enough time to fully explore it, but overall, of course, I'll vote for the bill, but I do have some very serious reservations.
Thank you, Representative. Any further concerns? Can you wait and vote?
Yeah, that's what I just said.
Okay,
1 second.
Great, thank you. Okay, any further questions or comments? If not, Debbie, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos.
Yes.
Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Yes.
Representative Kitty Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Wisnant.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
No.
Vice Chair Gomberg.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, Committee. Now we'll, Representative Gomberg, I've already opened the work session, right? So
that's
now
right.
We just need the motion.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3/15/13 to House Bill 3440.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the dash one amendment to House Bill 3440 dated 3/15/13. Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Did we discuss the amendments? It's not coming back to me. Previous.
Yes. Can you remind us what the amendment is, please, Regina?
Yes. It establishes 3 consecutive month time limit or until the household income exceeds 250% of the federal poverty guidelines on aid for families through temporary assistance for needy families. It broadens the TANF eligibility and services.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3440, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 3440 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion?
Quick question, Madam
yes.
Chair.
Yes.
The previous bill didn't have a referral. This bill does.
Yes. That's why we're sending it to Ways and Means.
Right.
He added it to it.
And Madam Chair, Tomei received the approval to have a subsequent referral added to the previous bill.
I never should have done it. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? Any discussion? Okay. If not, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Gallegos?
Yes.
Representative Zeltzer?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Wisnant?
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt?
Yes.
Vice Chair Gomberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Bill passes, and we'll go on to Ways and Means. Thank you, Christina. Thank you, committee.
Am I okay, Francisco?
Just give me the back.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you. Okay. Yes. Do we have anything here?
Does Deva have anything there?
Okay. Did I already announce that?
Wait, I just thought I'd try to make it earlier and go.
Is it no?
And we're good. Did we hear that? All right. So now we will open up public hearing, right?
You can.
Or it's a work session.
You can do either the work session 3135, or you can do the public 3132.
Greg, would you mind sticking around and let some of these people testify? Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3275.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3273 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact. The statement has not yet been issued. It creates a statewide audio newspaper service for persons who are experiencing blindness or print disability.
Oh, thank you very much.
3273.
Okay.
On the record.
Is it 75?
It is 73.
Yes, okay, 3273. I'm sorry. Thank you. All right. So we have Brant Wolf, Kendra Schauger, and Tina Hansen. Welcome to your capital.
Well, I've been here before, but thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I wasn't sure if it's from Tina.
Okay.
There's a microphone right here. All right.
And could I invite people to turn off their cell phones, please? Okay. Brant, do you want to go first?
I can. Absolutely.
Sure. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brant Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We're here in opposition to this bill. The association doesn't oppose the audio newspaper service per se. Our concern with this bill and with bills of this type, as we've expressed in many, many sessions, is that the Residential Service Protection Fund was created and is funded for the specific purpose of devices for deaf and hard of hearing individuals to access the telecommunications network. Our fear is that once the door is opened for that fund to be used for other things, that it's just very difficult to shut that door. And once you say yes to one particular group, how do you say no to the next one? The Residential Service Protection Fund is well managed by the Public Utility Commission of Oregon. It's a very streamlined, efficient organization. Our fear is that using the RSPF for something other than for which it was designed and is in place for is just it's a bad policy, and we oppose that notion. I apologize to the committee for not getting to any of you prior to the hearing. It kind of snuck up on me a little bit, but I will certainly follow up with each one of you. To summarize my testimony, we are opposed to this bill as it's written, and we ask this committee to oppose the bill as it's written and to not vote it out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Brant. Any questions of this witness? And I apologize. Normally, I would not let somebody who is opposed to a piece of legislation go first, and I just hadn't you signed up first, and so that's why I had you. And I know this is short notice.
I have a question.
Yes.
Who do you represent?
I'm sorry. I'm Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, the Oregon Telecommunications Association. We are the wireline telecommunications providers, all of them.
Who?
CenturyLink is our largest member. They represent most, they serve most of the landline telecommunications customers in the state. Our smallest member is Helix Telephone Company. It serves about 200 access lines in the town of Helix and Meacham. And we have members of all different sizes in between.
Follow up?
How many?
How many?
Organization. How many companies do you represent?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, we have 33 companies who are members of the organization. And that does not include wireless organizations or cable telecommunications. However, for the purposes of this testimony, I speak for the industry in a broader sense on this matter.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Brandon, I'm just curious here, looking at the bill, how many other states provide this service? Do you know?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I don't know how many states. I have a feeling there are folks in the room who might know. When this came up last session or in 2009, it seems to me as though there were two or three who did provide this service, but I'm not sure how they funded it. I don't think they funded it through an RSPF fund, but I could be wrong about that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Thank you. Okay. Kendra.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Kendra Schauber, and I'm with the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon, and I am for this getting the news line on to the RSPF. And the reason why is because I'm blind, and if I want to read the newspaper, I want to do it the same time, the same day as, let's say, my sighted sister. I believe that seven other states fund Newsline in this manner. And it doesn't take away from the RSPF. What it does is it expands the door to other groups other than just the deaf community. It expands opportunities for other groups, in our case, for the blind folk to stay connected to their current events without having to turn on the TV or in other ways than, let's say, watching TV or having to borrow someone's eyeballs to read the paper.
Thank you, Kendra.
You're welcome.
Did you have anything more to say?
I read the news sign. I read the newspaper through news sign. And I want to be able to do it the same day as my sighted sister.
Okay, great. Thank you, Kendra. Okay.
You're welcome.
Tina.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Tina, don't get quite so close to the microphone.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tina Hansen. I am also with the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. I'm also speaking in support of House Bill 3273. I myself also am a user of the NFB Newsline service. Basically, for those who don't know, that is a service that allows a blind person like myself to have access to the newspaper on a daily basis. And I like it because I can stay up with what is happening here in Salem, and if there's anything of interest, I can save it, make note of it. I'm especially keeping up on the whole transit issue, and I learned about the board changes in the fare policy from the NFB Newsline service, as I had access that day to the Statesman Journal. So I am speaking in support of this bill, and I understand the arguments that the opposition has voiced, but I believe that the opposition is probably concerned about opening up a Pandora's box, but I disagree with that. And so I am speaking in support of House Bill 3273. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Tina. Any questions? Yes, okay. Representative Whitsitt.
Are there computer applications that allow for you to call up a newspaper on your computer and it reads it to you?
Yes. We actually have a website. We actually offer this service in a variety of ways. In the beginning, it was only offered over the phone, but now it is also available online via the web, and people can also download it to an accessible media player that they have, or their MP3 player, or through their iPhone app if they have it. So there's a variety of ways that people can access the service.
Questions? Do you have further questions?
I guess I'm not understanding exactly what the bill is doing differently than what you're able to do now. I'm sorry, I just don't understand.
Madam Chair, it is a permanent funding because right now the service is sponsored by the Oregon Commission for the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon, and the Oregon State Library Talking Book and Braille Services. What we're concerned about is that because of the funds with the Commission for the Blind possibly drying up, we want funding to be made permanent.
Thank you. Good question. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Actually, that was my question, too, just trying to understand what you currently have and what you're trying to move for. So it's more of a funding issue. The service is already in place.
The service is in place, Madam Representative. The service is in place, but we are simply attempting to get a permanent funding stream so that the service can continue.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
So back to the first speaker, then. Why would you be in opposition? Does this...
No, I am in favor.
I'm sorry. The first speaker, the telecommunications... Why would the telecommunications industry be against this if it really... the service is still there. It's just shifting where the funding is coming from?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, the Residential Service Protection Fund is funded by a fee that every telecommunications provider or customer uses. I think the current amount is 13 cents. I believe it can be up to 35%. That's the statutory cap. Our fear is that if you begin to collect more than the current amount and use it for services other than what the Residential Service Protection Fund was designed to do, then as the other witnesses have said, it just opens up the floodgates for whatever worthy cause to come and say the exact same thing that these witnesses are saying. My cause is worthy. We can use this fund to fund this. And the causes are worthy. I have no arguments with that at all. It's the principle of using a fund for something other than what it was designed to be used for. That's our objection.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm reading through the bill, and I don't know if anybody on the panel can help me with this question, but I find it interesting. It says that the audio newspaper service would make newspapers available using a touch-tone telephone.
That is one of the options, yes.
Well, actually, it's the only option in the legislation, and I'm wondering whether touch-tone telephone might include mobile phones or portable devices, or whether the phrasing touch-tone telephone is a little bit too limited for where we might want to go.
As I understand it, we get services through NewsLine from many different sources, including the computer, the mobile device, the touch phone, telephone, like you said. I'm not sure if that might be a little limited, but considering that we're at the funding, not so much the mode to use it, we want a permanent funding solution because the current funders are, the budget's running out.
Yes, Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me how many people are subscribed to this now, and on average, how often, if you keep those kind of records, they use the service?
Well, we have other people
coming to testify. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you.
We don't have it on us.
Okay.
We don't have the answers on
us.
I'm sorry.
We'll see if we can find some answers. Thank you all very much. We have Art Stevenson, somebody McKenzie, and Michael Doherty.
Thanks, Art. Thank you.
And please identify yourself before you. Do you need help, dear?
Oh, thanks. Just get my equipment here.
Okay, somebody's coming over to help you.
It's her cane.
It's right behind you.
Debbie, can you help her?
Thanks.
She needs her cane.
Does she look him?
No, she needs her cane.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Oh,
it's back there.
Oh, I think that one's mine.
Yeah,
that one's mine.
No, I'm sorry.
Well,
I'm sorry, guys.
Just a minute.
Can
Can somebody help Tina? Who knows what Tina's after?
Yeah, that's her.
Okay.
Got it.
All right, good. That's okay, Tina.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, just announce who you are and you can continue talking. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, Representative Olson, distinguished members of the Human Services and Housing Committee. My name is Art Stevenson. I'm the Vice President of the National Federation of Blind of Oregon and also the Legislative Coordinator for the National Federation of Blind of Oregon. Our organization is the largest and oldest advocacy organization for the blind and visually impaired in the United States. I want to thank you for the opportunity of coming to testify today in order to try to get a permanent funding source for the Oregon Newsline program. To answer the question, there are 11 states who currently use this fund. I can't name them all to you, but I know Texas and Georgia are one of them. And the information pamphlets that I provided with you has the name of Mr. White, who is the Newsline coordinator for the Newsline program in the United States. And so if anybody has any serious questions about the overall operation of the program, feel free to give Mr. White a call and he can answer those questions. 8 years ago, the National Federation of Blind of Oregon, the Oregon Commission for the Blind, and the Oregon State Library brought to the state of Oregon the Newsline program. This was a wonderful opportunity for our state to allow disabled Oregonians to be able to access newspapers, periodicals, not only that exist here in Oregon, but also exist across the country in national newspapers like the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and the list goes on. There's hundreds of newspapers that blind Oregonians, print disabled Oregonians have been able to access for the last 8 years because of the Oregon Commission for the Blind, the State Library, and the National Federation of the Blind. For the last three sessions, we have come to this body because we knew there was a problem and we needed to resolve that problem, and that was to find permanent funding for this program. The Oregon Commission for the Blind and the State Library used to have very large donation funds which they helped to enhance programs for the blind. And I think most of you know that that funding and that source of income has now been used up by the state of Oregon to provide the other services for the Oregon Commission for the Blind. We knew this problem was there, and that's why we've been coming to this body for the last three sessions in order to procure permanent funding so that this state does not go backwards and we take away. I get a little emotional about this because it's been a long journey, and we don't want to see this service taken away from print disabled Oregonians. It's a great pleasure every day to wake up and be able to use your touch-tone phone, and now you can even use your iPhone or your computer, and be able to read the newspaper without any help. And I just can't tell you what a great service it has been and still is for the state of Oregon. But the simple fact of the matter is the Commission for the Blind and the State Library and the National Federation of the Blind can no longer fund this program. I wish we could, but we can't. And that's why we're coming to you to establish the fund through the existing PUC fund, the telecommunications fund, so that our print disabled citizens here in Oregon can access. We're not opening a Pandora's box, because you as legislators have control over that Pandora's box. What we're simply trying to do is to make sure that blind people and print disabled people here in Oregon can have access to one of the most helpful things, not only for blind children in education. Close your eyes and imagine that your teacher says, I want you to do a report from the Wall Street Journal, and you're not able to go to the newspaper and read it. But we can't. Blind students can now in Oregon because we have this service. Imagine you're a senior citizen is losing your eyesight through macular degeneration. Right now in Oregon, that blind senior can still read newspapers. If we don't have this program, they can't. This program is a great program, and so I'll be glad to answer any questions that I can on that, but I urge you all to support it. We're not opening a Pandora's box. What we're doing is maintaining a vital service in the state of Oregon for print disabled Oregonians.
Thank you very much. Art. Great. Go ahead, Ms. McKenzie.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I wish to just quickly...
Could you tell us your name first, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Charlotta McKenzie.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to quickly demonstrate NFB Newsline.
Charlotta, could you move the microphone away from you, dear?
Okay. This is how easily now I can read a newspaper. When before I could have never read a newspaper, I didn't know what was... I'm a news junkie. I get up at 4:30 and listen to Channel 2 News until time to go to work. And then I also... That's Portland news mostly, unless somebody gets shot in Salem. But I actually can read the Statesman Journal now. Okay. I ended up turning my voiceover off when I tried to not answer the phone.
Voiceover on.
Okay, there we go.
2:15. Home. NFB Newsline. Page 2 of 3. NFB Newsline. Double tap to open. NFB Newsline. NFB News Publications. New notification. Publication options. Alert. Publication options.
Here are your choices.
Publication options. All publications. Button. Favorites. Button. Magazines. Button. Oregon publications. Button. Oregon info. Button. Oregon publications.
Oregon publications.
Publications. Oregon publication. Capital O. Heading. Oregonian 04/10/2000. Capital R. Heading. Register Guard 0. Capital S. Heading. Salem Statesman Journal 0. Salem Statesman Journal.
That's great, Charlotte.
Facts, arts, culture, business 8
That's
articles.
Cool,
columnists 1 articles. Communities 10 articles. 93 articles.
And I was really into dining this morning. So I am just, it's a privilege to be able to read the newspaper. And I also, like Art, don't want that to be taken away from us. So I urge your vote on this matter to permanent fund this. For us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Charlotta.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Daugherty. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the Public Utility Commission of Oregon. We did have some testimony that was written by our program manager, John Cray, but right before the committee, he had a little emergency. Basically, the PUC is neutral on the bill. However, the RSPF, the Residential Service Protection Fund, it's not a really well-known fund, so I'm here mainly to answer any questions that you may have. Mr. Wolf was correct that we can have a surcharge up to 35 cents. The current surcharge for this year is 12 cents and has been that way for about the last 3 years. The RSPS really funds four different programs. The first one is the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program, which is a low-income subsidy. The second program is the Telephone Device Access Program, which actually allows us to loan devices to disabled, or they might be blind or deaf, but they're able to have access to the telephone. And also the Oregon Telephone Relay System is funded out of the RSPF. And then we also do something we call emergency medical certificates, which basically prevents people who have medical emergencies from having any utility cut off on them. So that's what the fund provides. The fund is approximately 11 to 12 million a biennium. And we try to keep it the low as we can. We try to manage the program very well. We think it's probably one of the better managed funds in the state of Oregon, but I'm sure you hear that from every agency. And so I'm just here to answer any questions that you may have about the fund.
Give me the figures again. How much?
The biennium is almost $12
million. $12
million. It's a 12 cents a month surcharge on phones.
Right. And so what is it used for now, Michael?
It's used for the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. That's the low-income subsidy,
okay,
which is $3.50
right.
a month, and that's combined with the federal subsidy of $9.25 a month to help low-income. We brought that bill before you of 135% of the federal poverty guideline below.
Right.
It also funds devices to allow people to have access to telephones that normally would not have access. That's for sight and vision and hearing impaired. And also the Oregon Telephone Relay System, that's the 711 system that allows disabled and non-disabled personnel to have access to telephones and be able to have that access they need to talk to other people.
So how much is in the fund now, Michael?
I don't have the balance of the fund. We try to keep a three-month balance, but it's...
Maybe 3 million...
At least 3 million. I can provide those figures.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks. Representative Whitson.
Maybe Art could answer this. Is there a software program from someone like Microsoft that, or an application that allows print on a computer screen or an iPhone to be translated into verbal when you bring it up? It reads out loud what is on the screen.
On the computer?
Uh-huh.
Who is that?
Representative Whitsitt, I'm sorry.
Representative Whitsitt, yes, there is...
Art, move back from the...
Oh,
back.
Sorry. There is software. It's called a screen reading program. There's a couple of different types that do allow... people who are print disabled to read the screen on the computer. One of the problems is that you have a lot of seniors who don't use computers, as you know, so they can access it through the telephone. There are some people that just aren't very good at using computers and stuff. Also, I'm terrible computer user myself, I hate to admit it, but you know, it's just so the different ways that print disabled people can access the thing, you know, kind of fits a broad spectrum, and computers are one of the ways that they can do it.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. Michael, the retail telephone subscribers, is that landlines?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, we actually have landline and wireless that we do have
okay.
subscribers.
So this is a charge. Currently, the 12 cents per month is on both.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes.
Okay. And Art, do you know how many people are subscribing to this? That's one question. And the other does the cost go up if you have more subscribers, or is it just flat rate because if there's a certain cost of providing it, it doesn't go up if you have more subscribers?
Chair Tomei, no. The one non-constant is individuals who use the 800 access.
Mm-hmm.
But
if you are in an area where you call in the number or you have unlimited long distance on your telephone, then the charge is constant. One of the things that we have not been able to do but we would like to see done is add some newspapers here in Oregon. We just have not been able to afford it. We would like to see a Southern Oregon newspaper added, like the what is that, the Medford Mail Tribune,
right.
and then a newspaper added for Bend. But those charges remain constant. The only fluctuating one is when the individual uses the 800 service for it.
Okay, so
and there are currently, you know, there's over 1,000 subscribers now for the service. That's not an exact number, but I can tell you, and there are more, you know, subscribing all the time. It's just being able to get out there and let people know that the service is available there. We have been working with the Department of Education, ensuring that you know, students are made aware of the program so they sign up to it and use it. We're working with the deafblind community in getting the word out, and that's, you know, it's been harder to do because we've been spending the money funding the actual program instead of being able to do as much outreach as we would like to.
Okay, and follow up, please.
Follow up.
Thank you. So if you went from 1,000 to 2,000 subscribers, I think when you were saying something about the 800, it's a cost to you, but is there an additional cost to the program if more people sign up, or
no.
It's a flat fee because it's the infrastructure.
The cost of the service pays for the actual newspapers that you have that you are running on the program. And so there would be a little bit of additional cost of adding
a few newspapers. Great. Thank you. That answers it. Thank you.
Thank you, panel. I really appreciate you coming to testify today. Thank you very much. And Representative Berger, I know you're here about this bill.
Members of the committee, Madam Chair, for the record, State Representative Vicki Berger from Salem, you probably know more after hearing this testimony than I do. I would refer really important questions to some of the folks who've already testified. I am sorry to be late coming. We've got a full room downstairs for the Rules Committee. But I wanted to commend this bill to you. In an aging population, I know that the technology is changing and it seems like it's going to solve all problems. But for the blind community, hearing something is important, and the telephone, it may be old technology, but it works at some level for a lot of folks, and it doesn't rely on computer skills, as been suggested, and some of the more advanced things. We are an aging population. Sight impairment is going to be more and more of an issue, and it is for a certain population already. If we can find a way to do this, it would help a lot of people stay connected with the things that concern them. And that's my policy goal here. This is a population that wants to be participatory, and they need information to do it. And if we can help them get the view of what's going on outside of this room and throughout the world by this technology that seems sort of simple, I hope we can find a way to do it. And that is why I bring this before you, and I really appreciate your attention to it today.
Thank you for coming today and for bringing us this piece of legislation. Any questions of Representative Berger? Seeing none, you get off easy.
Well, we'll go down and talk about corporate personhood.
Thank you.
And, oh, that's it.
Thank you.
Me too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to...
go down this way.
So I'm going to just briefly... We have a fiscal coming, and I think before we vote on this, we'll close it...
Temporarily?
Yes. Okay. House Bill 3273.
Oh, you have it?
Oh,
yeah.
Wait. I reopened it. Okay. Thank you.
For you or me? I got it here too.
Thank you.
So I think what I'd like to do, colleagues, is carry this over to next Monday. That will give us a chance to look at this,
yeah,
and maybe get more information as we need it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I will close the hearing or the work session on House Bill 3273 and carry it over to Monday, April 15th. Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming today and bringing us information that we didn't know we didn't have. So thank you so much for coming. Okay, colleagues, I'm going to open up the work session on House Bill 2205. We did get the fiscal.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2205 has no revenue impact and a fiscal statement was issued. It requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules to ensure that investigations of abuse of vulnerable persons are conducted in uniform, objective, and thorough manner throughout the state. It directs DHS to prepare an annual report to the Legislative Assembly regarding reports and complaints of abuse against vulnerable persons. It expands the crime of assault in third degree to include intentional physical injury to vulnerable persons. And it declares an emergency effective upon passage, and it does have an amendment that was discussed earlier.
And we passed it, as I recall. Isn't that correct, Representative Gilliam?
Yes.
So we've had several hearings on this piece of legislation. We heard those of us who are here in the past, we heard lots of testimony, and we passed an earlier bill that this is adding to. So are we ready to move this bill? Representative Gilliam? Would you like to move this bill today?
I would love to move this bill today, Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Olson, would you be willing to make the motion, or you want to pass it on to
Madam Chair,
him?
I'll move House Bill 2205 as amended to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2205 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I would just like to note the sentence. I'm going to vote for this, but I'd like to note the sentence that this bill is anticipated to have a fiscal impact on the district attorney in each county. District attorneys will need an indeterminate amount of resources for continuing, et cetera. And I just wanted on the record that Klamath County yesterday lost $225,000 of their district attorney money and will have to lay off two assistant district attorneys due to our problems with funding in the county. And I will vote this out of committee, but I need to make that very clear that Klamath County is under extreme duress right now.
Thank you, Representative. I think that's true for a lot of counties, especially the more rural counties in Oregon. And Representative Olson and I serve on the Judiciary Committee, and we're certainly hearing from the DAs and the judicial departments. So it's a tough time. So any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Rankles?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Kinnegeyer?
Aye.
Representative Wissman?
Aye.
Representative
Wissman? Aye.
Vice Chair Blumberg?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Gilliam, would you carry the bill on the floor?
I would be honored to, and I just wanted to add, Madam Chair, because I want to make sure we got the bill passed, that I'm glad that my good friend from Klamath County brought up her point. I hope she will continue to do so. I know you're sensitive to the rural county issue, and I want to remind committee members just quickly that our part of the of this bill regarding the
multidisciplinary teams
is permissive language simply because we did not want to lay a mandate on, but do not keep bringing up that issue, and I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? Thank you very much. And Representative Gilliam, thank you so much. I know it's been a lot of work for you, and I really appreciate all the time you've put into this.
You're thank very you. Kind. Thank you. It is a team effort. I appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, I know it is. That's great. Thank you. Did I close the work session on House Bill 2205? And we are going to open up the House Bill 3112. We don't have the fiscal yet, so we're going to carry that over again to April 15. Okay, and that's it, except, right? Okay, so I closed it, didn't I? Oh, I closed the work session, whatever that was. 3112. And I'm going to be opening the work session on House Bill 3131. And we've invited the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital to come and talk with us. We'd heard a bill earlier, 3131, colleagues, you may remember.
Madam Chair, go ahead. And members of the committee, House Bill 3131 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It does have an amendment, and it requires the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital to establish and implement program for continuous employment of healthcare professionals who provide specified services.
Just announce who you are.
Representative Tomei. For the record, I'm Greg Roberts. I'm the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital, and I'm here to provide information relative to staffing at the hospital, overtime at the hospital, really full staff, overtime use, et cetera, and to answer any questions.
Great. And did you happen to catch the testimony that we heard earlier this week?
I did, Friday.
Great. Perfect.
Yes. Yep. I can give you, I'd like to, just a brief version of, in response to some of the discussion on Friday. And by way of background, the Oregon State Hospital in Salem and Portland operates 24 and a half patient units, half being a 26-bed unit is operating with 13 beds at the present time. And the capacity of those beds is 633 patients. The types of units, the hospital is divided into five areas we call programs. The programs generally relate to the type of patient served. Harbor's program serves people who are guilty except for insanity or admitted to the hospital for evaluation of their ability to participate, to aid and assist in their defense. And those who are not able to aid in their and assist in their defense, our treatment programs are geared to restore them to competency so that they can. We have a TRAILS program, which is a stabilization unit for people who are past their acute stage but still require hospitalization. And the TRAILS unit, again, is mainly guilty except for insanity patients, but also some aid and assist patients. A BRIDGES program is our transitional program, four units there, nearly entirely guilty except for insanity, patients who are approaching, who are very stable and doing well in the hospital and approaching their discharge date. The SPRINGS program is four units of geriatric patients and medically infirm patients. And in Portland, we have three units that serve civilly committed patients. So one of the issues that came up last week was how do we determine our staffing needs for those programs? And it was we completed an analysis last year where we collected data. And I mentioned last year because that's when we moved into our new facility. There were seven or eight more units operating in the new facility than in the old facility. We did an analysis over time what the staffing patterns were becoming based on the census of the units and the acuity of the patients, meaning behavioral precautions. Patients are on one-to-one, sometimes two-to-one supervision. We did some through our lean methodology. We did some exercises called rapid process improvements. We involved direct care staff, union leadership, etc., to determine what looked like the necessary staffing levels for each unit on each shift. Following that, we proceeded to do an analysis of if you define what I just described as what we need, we then compared it to what we had. And we saw, obviously, the need for a redistribution of our staff. We had more nurses, RNs, on the evening shift than we required. We actually employed exactly the correct number of RNs, but they were inappropriately distributed. There were too many on one shift, too few on day shift, too few on night shift. The same was true for some mental health technicians. And then, as I think you've heard me say at prior testimony, we implemented new schedules for our staff that where half of our staff have a Monday to Friday schedule, and half of our staff have weekend schedules. So they work a three-day work week, either Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, or Saturday, Sunday, Monday. And that gives us, then those, the number of staff assigned in that fashion correlate to what our analyses told us we need per unit per shift. We expanded the use of relief pool workers. As you heard on Friday, this is divided into limited duration staff who are able to work up to 17 months and temporary workers who can work up to 1,040 hours before they no longer can be a temporary worker. So the combination of all those factors reduced our reliance on overtime very significantly. It nearly eliminated our use of mandatory overtime, which was a significant problem at the hospital, and also significantly reduced our reliance on agency staff, people we call from an agency as needed. And you should have in front of you a copy of a chart that shows the pattern of mandated overtime from July 2011 to March 2013. And then you also should have a printout of the nursing department staffing needs at the hospital. The 24 and a half units operating, utilizing the analysis I described, we require 229 RNs. This is how many people we need to employ, 58 LPNs, and 576 mental health technicians. As of March 25th is the most recent data we had. We employ full-time 216 RNs, 56 LPNs, 543 mental health technicians. And then we add to those numbers the relief pool, 28 RNs and 43 MHTs. So when you look at the total at the bottom, we actually employ full-time and relief pool staff, and this is just for the patient units. There are other staff in these titles. 244 RNs, 56 LPNs, 586 MHTs. And that the total number of staff required for the nursing department is 980, and that represents 53.7% of the total hospital staffing need, obviously. So the recent issues that have affected this discussion are the fact last year we also were able, because our census was low enough, we did not need to open and operate all of the units in our new Salem Hospital. There were, for at some period of time, three units closed. Now there are 2.5 units closed. Our census did increase. We talked that again. Talked about that previously, especially because of that aid and assist population. Significant increases there. So we did reopen half of one unit, 13 beds. We are experiencing a higher acuity than we anticipated for our patients in terms of behavioral problems, especially aggression. We have more patients on one-to-one and two-to-one supervision. And we currently have some counting vacancies. Between mental health techs and RNs, nearly 45 vacant full-time positions that we are in the process of filling. And actually may be a little high. I think it's more toward 40. But so we have vacant positions, and we are also looking to fill positions in our relief pools. So the combination of those factors have recreated the emergence of mandatory overtime. If you see February and March of 2013 on an upward trend where last year, very low numbers for mandatory overtime. And also overtime use itself is increasing right now because of these factors. But as we proceed to hire staff into our full-time positions and into our relief pool positions, we anticipate a return to reduced need on overtime, reduced need for agency staff, and reduced need for mandatory overtime as well.
So, Greg, what we heard from earlier, I can't remember what day that was, the 5th, was that they were asking for a relief pool of nurses and online staff. That would be the mental health technician, is that what the title is? Right. So help us understand. So some people are hired temporarily, but they can only work for
1,040 hours.
Right.
Yes.
And then, so then you've got to hire another person in that same position. So help me understand. Maybe I'm the only person that doesn't understand this. Why there wouldn't be a pool that would be, some of them would be part-time, but also some would be full-time to go where you would need them when somebody's on vacation or has a child who is sick or they themselves are sick, et cetera. So help us understand
Madam
that.
Madam Chair, can I just chime in on what you said too? So I'm interested too in what the Chair just asked you, but I mean, from the two thoughts, the temporary employee for the 1039 hour that comes back, and then also the limited duration for the 17-month periods.
Right. Yeah.
Representative Tomei, Representative Olson, the current numbers for the limited duration and temporary staff is 110. And not all of those positions are filled. We have 30 or 40 vacancies there as well we're looking to fill. Those are all people who work full-time at the hospital. So and they do offset the need for overtime or agency use for people who are out on FEMLA or OFLA or call out sick or because of increased acuity. Mm-hmm. So part of the question is the size of that pool. We actually calculated the need, the size of the relief pool, based on the desire not to have to lose people before they reach 17 months of 1,040 hours. So looking at our
somebody
attrition,
might be there temporarily, but if they work out, you might hire them on an ongoing basis?
I think you'll be surprised to hear this, and we, Human Resources Department, triple-check this for me. In 2012, not one limited duration and not one temporary employee was dismissed, having reached their maximum number of hours. And I can tell you why I think that's true. When we calculated the need for 110 people in the current relief pool, we looked at our attrition rates, we looked at our need for full-time staff, and we didn't want to create, in effect, a relief pool of 200 people, mm-hmm. or we would run into that problem. We wouldn't have full-time positions available for those people when they reached their maximum hours if the relief pool became too large. So we were doing a bit of a balancing act, saying we want the relief pool to be right-sized, and we don't want to lose people when they reach their maximum mm-hmm. months or hours. And the fact is, in 2012, not a single person lost their position at the hospital because they had reached their maximum hours, although the potential
is there. If I were one of those people, I would think I can only work so many more hours, so I'll find a permanent job somewhere else. Could that be the case?
Representative Tomei, what happens is that people are able to find a full-time position at the hospital. There's a certain flow to it. If you may be hired as a temporary worker, and as you approach your 1,040 hours, mm-hmm. you'll move into a limited duration position, which then gives you 17 months more to work because limited duration people have moved into full-time positions.
So it's sort of a flow.
Correct.
Part-time to full-time, temporary to full-time.
Representative, they're all full-time. They work 40 hours a week for the most part, and it's just that they come into one category, temporary worker, become a limited duration worker, and then a full-time worker.
Perfect.
Representative Gelson, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a couple questions.
Sure, go.
So I appreciate that there's a flow and people are classified in different ways, but the testimony that we heard and the nursing logs that we saw shows that despite your efforts, there are still significant understaffing problems. I've heard from the nurses that including in maximum security units, there are daily shortages of 15 to 20 staff, and in those nursing logs, you could see that impact and inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint that puts staff and patients at risk. How is it that there can be such extreme understaffing, and what is the state hospital doing, and what proposal do you have, if not a float pool, to make sure that we have adequate staffing on every shift, on every unit at the hospital, every day of every week?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gelser, the referral to the word shortage, I think, is a relative term. I brought today's staffing numbers for that area of the hospital. For Anchors 1, which is one of the Harbors units, we had 9 staff for 20 patients and 3 additional staff for 3 patients on one-to-one. On the next unit, we had 8 staff for 16 patients, and 2 staff for 1 patient on 2-to-1. The next unit had 10 staff for 18 patients and no patients on 1-to-1. The next unit had 6 staff for 12 patients and 6 additional staff for a special program we call the South Hall. The next unit had 5 staff for 15 patients and 3 staff for 3 patients on 1-to-1. So the units would describe that as being short of a target number that has been established for each unit. So if we say a unit had 12 staff, it would prefer to have 14. That's how the word "we were short of staff" comes up. But when you look at the ratio of staff to patients, as I described.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, I have to follow up. When I look at the nursing logs, I'm not a practitioner. I don't work there. I visited. I was concerned about what I saw when I went. I was concerned about the conditions for staff and for patients. I was concerned about a culture that was somewhat violent. What I saw in those nursing logs, have you seen the nursing logs that were shared with the committee?
Representative Gill, sorry, I have not.
All right, I believe that they are in OLIS, but they described things like people being put into seclusion for calling staff names, for spitting on someone, for spilling water. There were comments about these behaviors taking place because there weren't enough staff to carry out the activities that were on that person's plan. So to me, it seems like a shortage would be when there aren't enough people to carry out the activities that are on the treatment plans of the individuals to keep the patients and the staff safe, and anything that leads to the inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint, because what was described in those logs is not consistent with the policy that you've provided or that the hospital has provided me around what the requirements would be for the use of seclusion and restraint, both in the initiation and for the duration of their use.
Representative Tomei and Representative Gelser, the hospital has been focused, I think you've heard us reference in the past, to an initiative called Culture of Safety. And in my previous visit to this committee, we talked about the urgent need for training of our staff. It's the numbers of staff are what I described. The issue that is on our table as probably our highest priority is the competency of our staff, the training of our staff, the skills that our staff have to know how to intervene, how to see early warning signs of escalating behavior, and how to react to that behavior so that the patient does not end up hurting someone, hurting themselves, and or in seclusion or restraint. So the point there is that it's from our point of view, much more of a training staff development issue than it is a numbers issue. If we added staff to these units who do not have the training that they need to work with those patients, it doesn't accomplish much. We need those staff to be skilled at their position. And I'm not degrading the skills. I have wonderful staff, and that's a difficult area of the hospital, absolutely. But what we're focusing on right now, and we've started the programs and started to see some positive results, is really a training emphasis.
I guess a follow-up. Thank you. I'm very concerned with what I saw in those logs. I'm concerned about the impact on staff. I'm very concerned about the impact on patients. It appeared to be very clear violations of your own seclusion and restraint policy, and I think that ties directly back to inadequate staffing and training. I think it's very important that people have access to training. If it is not possible for the state hospital to provide adequate staffing levels or staff that are adequately provided adequate training to meet your protocols, how do you propose you will meet that staffing shortage in this hospital and staff an entirely new hospital in another city at the same time? And follow your policies on things like seclusion and restraint and staffing levels?
Representative Tomei, Representative Geltzer's great question. We expect that the policy on seclusion and restraint will be strictly followed. There are many federal laws that apply about that, as well as hospital policy. We review episodes of seclusion and restraint on a daily basis. We have a hospital at the committee, a seclusion and restraint review committee, and the goal of that is to find ways to reduce and eventually eliminate the use of seclusion and restraint, as has been accomplished in other states across the country. But it is, I can tell you, it's much more a training competency issue than it is a numbers issue.
And I didn't hear an answer to the second question, the numbers issue. I mean, we see the mandated overtime. We hear that whether you call it a shortage or not, you're not at that ideal level. How will you staff a whole new hospital if you haven't yet been able to staff the hospital that we have?
Representative Tomei and Representative Geltzer, I would say we have staffed the hospital that we have. We have 980 employees dedicated to the nursing units of the hospital. Our RN to patient ratio is one nurse to 2.7 patients. Our ratio of mental health techs to patients is 1 to 1.1, which exceeds other states that we have reached out to for comparative studies.
Right, one last follow-up.
Joe, I'm going to move on. We have other questions. Thank you. Representative Gallegos.
Well, actually, my question was, and I wanted to thank you, Superintendent, for your numbers. Appreciate them. I was trying to write them down as they're coming at us. But it's a similar question that was asked by Representative Geltzer. But I want to come at it maybe a little different way. I'm interested in level of care and how that relates then to the ratios you just mentioned. You said the ratio, the standard ratio is what, 1 to 2.7. Is that correct?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gallegos, that's our existing ratio.
Yeah. Yes. And then earlier on, you mentioned that on one floor you did not have a 1-to-1 situation in the whole hospital. How many 1-to-1 situations?
Representative Tomei, Representative Gallegos, I checked that. There's about 18 patients on 1-to-1 today, and 3 on 2-to-1.
So my question really gets, like I said, level of care. I mean, I can just imagine that it's not just a matter of ratio matching a staff to a patient, but then with these even volatile patients or patients whose acuity might shift during the day, you might need a different pattern, a different ratio. So would that be true or not? I mean, and then you'd need additional staff then. You'd need to maybe go down to a 1-to-1 or... am I being clear? I don't know.
Madam Chair and Representative Gallegos, yes, absolutely. Things happen throughout the day cause the nursing office to have to adjust its staffing level, sometimes floating one employee from one unit to another unit for a number of reasons. Yeah. Sure.
Okay. Okay, Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a remarkably short bill, but I think I understand the concept is to maintain a pool of people who are experienced and to use that experience to offset overtime. I want to try and go from the general to the specific. Superintendent, I understand this week we had an unfortunate situation and four of your staff were taken to emergency, and I'm wondering whether that may have resulted from fatigue, from experience, from training, or from staffing levels.
Madam Chair and Representative Gomberg, yes, an incident occurred yesterday on our Harbors unit where I would say five to six staff are, this is our South Hall program, as I mentioned, before very difficult patients, a specialized program to deal with their behavior. So in terms of numbers of staffing, there are never less than five or six patients in that hallway for, I'll say, eight or nine. Patients. So this particular patient did something in his room that caused the staff to need to enter his room. He became assaultive. He had spread some soap and water around the floor. It was slippery. Staff were falling, and some staff were injured. Yes.
I'm sorry. Oh, Madam Chair, I just want to reiterate part of the question. Do you think that staffing levels, fatigue, training, experience may have contributed to the injuries in this case?
Madam Chair and Representative Gomberg, I'm sorry for not answering that the first time. In that instance, I would say no. In fact, the staff on the South Hall are specifically trained in what's called safe containment, safe methods of physical intervention, de-escalation techniques, motivational interviewing, and such. So. It was not, I could check, but I'm not aware that any of those staff were working a double shift or, were fatigued in any way. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kenny Gardner.
Thank you. I think it's building on this a little bit. Can you talk about staffing emergencies, what might constitute that, if there's a difference between the weekend and during the week, how you're handling that? Because numbers are just ratios, but, I would think they're very different conditions. I don't know if the three-day people work longer hours on the weekend and if there are more emergencies during those times.
Madam Chair and Representative Kenny Geyer, good point also. The goal is to have the same number of staff on weekdays and weekends. Mm-hmm. We have been seeing and experiencing problems on weekends. Mm-hmm. If I could back up just a bit, the way the system was designed to work was not, the goal initially was not to eliminate overtime, although we knew overtime would go down. Mm-hmm. It was to eliminate mandatory overtime. Mm-hmm. So if I say on a particular unit we want to have 10 staff scheduled on Saturday and we only have 8, then we look to pre-schedule the overtime or use the relief pool to fill in those 10. And we also look to anticipate what the data tells us in terms of call-outs or acuity or things to have. We may have 12 or 13 staff attempting to be hired for the weekend where we need 10. So the problem arises when people don't sign up for the voluntary overtime or there are call-outs, and that relates to the FEMLA issue that I know came up last week, or people who have signed up for the overtime, what's called self-cancel. They change their mind about working the overtime. Mm-hmm. So I might be sitting here thinking I have 13 people coming in, mm-hmm. three or four of them decide they change their mind about overtime, mm-hmm. and therefore you are scrambling a bit at the last minute for the coverage mm-hmm. That you're looking for. But
what's considered an emergency?
It can be. Yeah. If it's extensive enough throughout the hospital, I have the authority to declare a staffing emergency, mm-hmm. and that leads to people being mandated for the overtime, including on what's called mandated on your Friday. So if it's your last day of the week mm-hmm. to work, let's say if you're a Monday to Friday worker and today's Friday, mm-hmm. and now we have a staffing emergency, you can be mandated to work on your Friday when normally you would not be. So, those things. Now, in terms of the data, and again, we have committees at the hospital that look at this all the time. We do not see a correlation between patient-to-patient assaults, patient-to-staff assaults, use of seclusion, and use of restraints, comparing weekdays to weekends. So even though weekends, we do see that staffing on the weekends is less than it is during the week, the weekends are not the highest periods for any of those categories. We actually have more assaults during the week than on weekends. We have more seclusion use and restraint use during the week than on weekends. Mm-hmm. So we don't see a correlation there. And if I could say this, I always really want to add this when I'm speaking. I don't want to come across in any way as saying these aren't problems. Assaults are a problem. Patient-to-patient assaults, patient-to-staff assaults are a problem. Inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint is a problem. Right? I don't mean to diminish in anything I say. If a staff member gets injured, we're upset about that. But the data, I'm trying to explain how the staffing fits into that, how the relief pool fits into that, and how we've been able actually to be successful relying less on overtime and agency staff pretty significantly in the past year, because those do contribute to the problem.
I'm curious that there are fewer incidents on the weekend. Is that because there? I know you have ongoing group meetings, et cetera. So does that happen only Monday through Friday? So maybe they're not having those interactions on the weekend?
Representative Tomei, it's a good question. Actually, it's one of the things the committee tries to drill down into is which day of the week, what time of the day incidents occur. They have all the data, patients, individual patients who engage in multiple aggressive acts, or patients who are frequently in restraint or seclusion. Mm-hmm. And on that note, I can tell you 80% of our patients last year didn't have a single episode of assault. 20% of our patients engaged in assaultive acts, and 5% of those 20% mm-hmm. accounted for 80% of those assaults. So the problem is significant with a small portion of our population, and those are the people in our Harbors units and in our South Hall program. They're very difficult, very assaultive people.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes. I was wondering, are you neutral on this bill? I think when we heard from the hospital last Friday, she said the hospital was neutral. Where are you?
Representative Tomei and Representative Whitsitt, I think I'm obligated to be officially neutral on any bill.
Okay.
So if you were to ask me a different question, which I'll pretend you asked, I would say the issue is that we do need relief pools, and I would say a missing piece of a puzzle for us right now are part-time workers, which Dan Smith, who was here from SEIU on Friday, did reference. We have full-time limited duration people. We have full-time relief pool staff. We will need more of them in the year coming up, because if, as we anticipate, the Blue Mountain Regional Center is closed, we will reopen the three units that are currently closed at Salem. Our staffing need will go up, and therefore our need for relief pool people will go up. But what one element we don't have in that mix are part-time workers, because it's flexibility that's required in this discussion, so that when you need the additional staff, you can have the additional staff. So right now we're focusing all of our hiring for relief pool for the weekends, because that's where we need the staff. It would be beneficial to have that additional flexibility, not just full-time workers, but part-time workers.
May I follow up? So when you reach full-time staffing, do you need this bill? Do you need the relief pool? Yeah, when you reach full-time staffing, which you're working for and which you had last summer.
Representative Tomei and Representative Whitsitt, perfect way for me. The answer is yes. And the reason is because even when you have full-time staffing, some people are on vacation, some people are calling out sick, people do have FEMLA coverage, and I wanted to clarify one point about that issue. So there are always reasons. Even though you employ 900 people, not all 900 people are coming to work for various reasons. So the relief pool fills in for that need. If you didn't have the relief pool, you would have overtime, or you would be using agency people. The point I wanted to clarify about FEMLA, as I listened to the audio of the hearing on Friday, it's not accurate to think that on any particular day, 30% of our staff are out of work using FEMLA. What that data represents is that 30% of the staff who work in our nursing department have submitted documentation to our human resources department that qualifies them to use FEMLA. So, meaning they have to use FEMLA, you need to document that you have a family member or such a who requires your care. So some of those people are out on what we call constant FEMLA, long-term leave using FEMLA. Most, two-thirds of those people are use what's called intermittent FEMLA. So they've documented that they qualify to use sick leave under the FEMLA law. And they may, on any particular day, they may call up and say, my son is sick, I'm taking a FEMLA day. But it's not 30% of the staff every day. It's 30% of the staff in nursing have submitted that documentation.
That's a great clarification. Thank you for that. That was startling. Representative Lisbon.
Thank you. Real quick, Madam Chair. Superintendent, all of us have been lobbied, and we sort of felt compassion convinced about a lot of overtime by your staff. I've worked in Ways and Means, and I think that this bill passes. It could help you go into Ways and Means, and I think that we all feel like you need more help. And only thing I would suggest is maybe in your recommendation, if you need more nurses and staff, that you look at maybe going higher in full time, because what we were presented with is that they're working a lot of overtime, and sometimes it can be cheaper to the state if you have more full-time, expecting them to work some overtime, but not too much overtime. And that's, I don't like to micromanage and wish you luck. And I'll keep our patients and our nurses safe, right. Please.
Representative Tomei and Representative Wisnett, absolutely true. And that's why we can point. It's a glass half full, half empty. I can tell you on one hand that we reduce our overtime from 30,000 hours a month to less than 20,000 hours a month. But 20,000 hours a month is still a lot of overtime. So,
Madam Chair, so that would be, if you take a time in half, it's going to be a lot less FTEs.
So, yes, and as I said, with the changes in the hospital coming, we will need more staff. Therefore, we will need more of a relief pool to avoid overtime returning.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to say that I think intense scrutiny is an important thing on a part of this committee or other committees. And but I just want to be clear that I appreciate, Director, your work you're doing. I appreciate your candor. I appreciate you coming here and your attitude. I would just suggest, I don't want to cause more trouble for you over there or more difficulty, but Madam Chair, as I look at this committee, with the exception of Representative Gelser, who obviously has been on a tour on her own, you and I were the only ones that toured from the last session. And as our plate gets clear, I would suggest you weren't on the one we were on.
I've been on one.
Well, big deal. I'm talking about last time.
The one.
And I would suggest we might want to do it again.
I think it's a great idea. We'll be sure to do that. Not on a Friday.
Yeah.
How about a Saturday?
Saturday.
Representative Tomei and Representative Gilliam, we're open to that. We enjoy taking people on a tour. And just to settle any questions, if you come for a tour, you tell me where you want to go, and that's where we'll go. I think it's important that if it's transparent, we don't want to feel like we're putting on a show. I think those of you who have come out, that's how we've done it, and I want you to feel confident that what you see is what every day happens. So. And again, the theme is, every time I speak to the legislature and other groups, please don't hear me saying that Oregon State Hospital is now just a wonderfully great institution. It is a better institution than it was a few years ago in many ways, many important ways. But we still have serious problems, and we're still working on them. We have a long way to go. But it's better, but it's not where it needs to be.
Any further questions or comments? Colleagues, I've worked with Greg since he's started here in Oregon, and he's done wonderful things at the hospital. The problems are not all over, but it's certainly a huge improvement over what it was, and I want to thank you for your service.
Representative, you have a team effort.
Yes.
You have a great team.
Yes, thank you. And colleagues, my intention, I'm going to carry this over to
Monday, the work session. And during the time, after we're through with all of our House bills, which will be a week from today, I'm hoping we can spend more time in the hospital. We hear bills, and so we hear one portion of an issue. And I'd really like for us to look at the whole hospital. We'll go on a tour. We'll come back. We'll talk to some of the people who work at the hospital. We'll talk more with staff, with Greg, and with others at the hospital. And it's important that we understand about the hospital, how difficult it is, what a hard job not only he but other people who work at the hospital, what a tough job that is. And I think it's our responsibility to learn more about it and understand what it is we can do. So with that, thank you again for coming. I will close the work session on House Bill 3131 and carry it over to Monday, the 15th, right? And I just want to make clear, I am holding over House Bill 2781 until Monday, 3032 to Wednesday, 3007 to Monday, 3112 Monday, 3244 Friday, 3273 Monday. Wow. How about that? Anything else?
Hit it one more time.
Close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you, Committee.